Saturday, August 20th, was a day filled to the last quivering minute with scenery, signs, sensations, and crowds of people at airports and in parks on our five-state tour of New England. A day like this is an exhausting seminar on the geography, economy, the look of the land and the people that make up our country. It began early at the Neverlee Hotel in Ellenville, nestled in the valley of the Catskill Mountains in the Hudson River country. We left luxurious suite about 9 o'clock and made our way through crowds of vacationing summer people who had a helicopter waited us on what appeared to be a sort of a golf course. We flew to Stewart Air Force Base and from there in the 707 to Providence, Rhode Island, and then motorcaded in to Rhode Island University. At every airport, the fence was lined with what seemed like thousands of people, many of them children, lots with cameras, nearly all smiling. There are lots of signs, many homemade, nearly all friendly, school bands and pretty girls with batons briskly playing their welcome. When Lennon approaches such a crowd, he's likely to turn in one direction, quickly shaking hands as he strides along, smiling a quick greeting, a long handshake, a stop at a pretty child. And I usually go in the other direction, because if he doesn't get to see them all, seeing me is at least something of a substitute. Linda had joined us at the 707, and she went to still another part of the line. Some people don't shake hands, they cling. There's always the little boy sitting on his daddy's shoulders, another little boy shinnying up a tree or a flagpole. And there's always a solemn-faced youngsters, too small to reach above the fence, and I try to lean down and talk to them. I never have the feeling that crowds can be dangerous, except in stepping on each other's feet, and perhaps in pushing against a small child, as Linda and I try to move through. There is, on the other hand, a current of feeling that you can almost touch between the president and the crowd, of interest, of excitement, of almost a sustaining strength. Up to now in our life, except for a few interludes like the time in Dallas, it's been a feeling of great warmth and friendliness. Knowing its power, I can understand something of the danger if that feeling changed to hostility. There's always the patient-faced old lady, the rough-handed factory worker, farmer whose face is browned by many summers. Do I imagine that he looks more philosophical than the rest? The little girl who simply couldn't get on another freckle. The sober young men in uniform. A crowd is a wonderful pageantry of America. I have so many vignettes in my mind, like Saturday Evening Post covers of scenes from crowds. Two, I don't remember where they were even. One of a group of nuns standing at a corner, jumping up and down in giddy excitement, their black habits bobbing, shrieking like teenagers. And another was just as we rounded a corner. There were a group of little girls, about 4 to 8 years old, all dressed in leotards or fluffy ballet skirts, waiting for the president's car. Apparently, a dancing class in a nearby building had turned out to await his arrival. Well, I'm sure if I, at 4 years of age, had ever seen a president, I would remember it. The first real speech of the day was at Rhode Island University in Kingston. Lyndon put on his cap and gown. There was a platform in the quadrangle, surrounded by the old buildings. I have a memory of red brick and ivy and a sea of faces. And in the right-hand rear of the quadrangle, a slowly moving line of demonstrators against Vietnam. One huge sign, "Stop Escalation." Others I could barely see, except the words "bomb," "Vietnam," "peace." It was a good speech on restraint and civil rights demonstrations. The Molotov cocktail, Lyndon said, destroys far more than the police car or pawn shop. It destroys the basis for civil peace and social progress. And also, speaking of civil rights demonstrators themselves, no one needs the law more than they. Further on, he underscored, breaking the chain of poverty will require time. We deceive ourselves and the poor as well if we imagine there is some magic sword that can cut this chain with a stroke. The gist of it seemed to me to be that violent protest will block the demonstrators from the goals they seek by hardening white resistance to equality for Negroes. Lyndon received an honorary degree, accompanied by a very pleasing encomium of his role in public service. And then he was swiftly off to Quonset Air Station in the second speech of the day, Manchester, New Hampshire. My only objection to campaigning in New England is that it's so heavily populated there's never time to catch your breath between stops. There were only 30 minutes here. Sometime along the way, I've forgotten just when, Lyndon found out it was Senator Aiken's birthday, and he ordered up a birthday cake, one not being available immediately on the expression of the wish, the resourceful steward brought up a large Danish pastry with a candle in it, and we all, governors, senators, congressmen, Linda and I, sang happy birthday to that delightful old gentleman, and Lyndon produced some hastily wrapped Air Force One bridge cards and presidential seal cufflinks and some autographed pictures. He never puts off for the next hour what can be done in this one. We arrived at Manchester, New Hampshire, about 30 minutes late, a little after noon. Here the crowds were the least of the whole day's trip, and Lyndon, sensing this, waited until we rounded a corner close to the Sheraton Carpenter Hotel where we were to speak, then stopped and walked the last block, which plunged him into the midst of the thickest portion of the crowd, a good idea for wire service pictures. Here in Manchester, the speech was before the Navy League luncheon. Ravenous, I quickly observed that the plates had not been served. Some had tomato juice, and some nothing yet. And here we were 30 minutes behind when I saw Lyndon give the nod to the master of ceremonies that he would like to deliver his speech right away. I thought perhaps it was to accommodate the newsmen with deadlines. It was a good speech on Vietnam, that now much-worn subject. I remember particularly a line, "Perhaps it reflects poorly on our world that men must fight limited wars to keep from fighting larger wars. But that is the condition of the world." And another one, "The restrained use of power has for 21 years prevented the wholesale destruction the world faced in 1914 and again in 1939. And then a warning for the next few months. We can expect more intimidation and terror in South Vietnam. As the September elections draw near, we can expect more kidnapping and murder, more raids against civilian leaders, more atrocities, and more acts of sabotage." There was a young soldier in the crowd, and when I saw Lyndon reach over and introduce him and ask him to stand up, I felt sure from his face that it was a complete surprise. He was just back wounded from a tour in Vietnam, and he became a part of the speech. When he finished, Lyndon signaled that we would leave right away, and I expressed my apologies and dismay to the master of ceremonies over my shoulder as I hurried out, still ravenous and barely sustained by the one piece of Melba toast I had, unobtrusively I hoped, eaten during the speech. Our next stop was Burlington, Vermont, and here we were met at the foot of the airplane with the inevitable bouquet of flowers by a handsome young Governor Hoff, his wife, and three children. We boarded helicopters and went to inspect, from high aloft, a tri-town water system, the first of its kind in the United States, a water supply system financed by the state of Vermont, the United States Department of Agriculture, servicing Addison, Bridport, and Shoreham. It was Senator Aiken's very special project, and it was actually why we were here, because he had asked Lyndon on a boat trip on the Potomac to come up and dedicate it. He feels that such systems will soon be as matter of course as REA projects. It was beautiful country. Lake Champlain below us, sparkling, clean, beautiful. What a contrast to Lake Erie and its pollution. The Green Mountains on one side, and in the distance the Adirondacks in New York. And below us, farms so lush and green and manicured that they look like country clubs. Senator Aiken said they counted the population in people and cows, and a sign on the outskirts of any village was likely to recount the number of each. It was great dairying country. It had originally been the breeding place for Merino sheep, and from there the sheep had gone to Australia, now becoming the mainstay of their economy. It was a land you could fall in love with. Vermont is one of my favorite states. Someday I'm coming back and hunt for covered bridges and see their museums, follow autumn from Maine down through Vermont, all the way down to Virginia. Somewhere along the way, Senator Aiken said, "As long as people are proud of their own community and love it, we're going to be all right." I could sense a deep feeling of love of the land in his voice, and how well I understand him, and I too think it's a bulwark of good citizenship and bodes well for the nation made up of such communities. We arrived at Battery Park, an absolute picture of a place, elm-shaded, peaceful, bordering on Lake Champlain with a view that made me want to sit backwards on the platform. There were militiamen, I suppose, in the Revolutionary Day costume of Green Mountain Boys, standing at attention at each side of the platform. There were spades for all the officials, governors, senators, Lyndon, everybody who was supposed to participate in this symbolical groundbreaking for the water district. For half a dozen or so speeches, a particularly wonderful introduction by Governor Hoff, somewhere during the day, Lyndon had got started on asking me to stand up and say a few words. I cannot even remember whether I did here, but I know that I was most moved to do so here than anywhere, because I simply loved it. There were lots of signs, some thanking me for my part in the beautification program. The inevitable ones for Pat and Lucy. We love Lucy. Hello, Pat and Lucy, hello. There was an antique commemorative plate for me. Old English ironstone. A jewel of a piece for the ranch. Dorothy Torito will never get this. Appropriately enough, Lyndon's speech here was on beautification and conservation. For the first time, he said, America is winning the battle of conservation. Every year now, we are saving more land than we are losing. He went on to explain that as bulldozers claimed millions of acres a year for expanding cities, we were, this year, gaining more than that for recreational use in parks and public domain, I believe. And then a salute to Lake Champlain. We are a people whose national character was forged in the out-of-doors among just this kind of God-given splendor. I want to pledge to you today that we will retain that splendor in America. This speech got the least lines in the press of any of the day. I wonder if it was the time. To me, it was the most memorable, the most enchanting spot. And then we were gone to the airport in a 35-minute hop to Brunswick Naval Air Station in Maine. And from there was one of the best times of the day, a 24-mile motorcade to Lewiston, with me sitting by Senator Smith, and learning about her state and also her service. She'd been with Lyndon on the Naval Affairs Committee for many years, and then later the Armed Services Committee. And there's a strong bond between them, a great respect and liking on Lyndon's part, I know, completely untrammeled by the difference in parties. She told me about the types of ships, and she gave me the difference between a ship and a boat. A ship, she said, is big enough to carry another boat. The one we would be on tonight is a USS Northampton, a cruiser, which she explained to me is the next largest after a battleship, which in fact is now defunct and has been replaced by the aircraft carrier. I'm always enormously impressed by a woman who has mastered a man's world as well as Senator Smith has, and who is so disciplined. She comes to Maine, she says, at least once a month. She has her own house here, even if she can only spend a weekend in it. Here in Maine, it was time for Senator Muskie to step to the fore also. He and Lyndon rode together as we approached Lewiston City Park, where President Kennedy had ended his road trip before the 1960 election, making our way slowly through a crowd of more than 20,000 people. It is a little town, and the only word for the park is quaint. It was a bandstand with a lot of gingerbread on it, decorated with red and white and blue bunting, and the date 1861 close to the top. There was a statue of the Union soldier to the right of the bandstand. There were flags and balloons everywhere, and someone delightfully had put a flag in the crook of the arm of the soldier. And on the left, there was a water fountain. Vintage 1890, I'd bet. It all looked like a page out of history. We were late. It was just about twilight. All the faces in the park were upturned, expectant. An escaped balloon rose above the treetops. One of our staff members, Milt Seymour, I believe it was waving at his relatives. In sign of the times, there was a group of young girls, mostly Negro, down below us from a Job Corps camp in a nearby town. Lyndon's speech this time was on inflation. What America needs more than anything else right now is a strong dose of self-discipline. Dangers of excess are real. In our cities, excess decay. In our streets, excess violence. In our economy, excess indifference to the public interest. He warned that unless there is restraint now, voluntary self-discipline by management and labor, your government will be compelled by sheer necessity to take action to curb inflation. And then he left the text and launched into a description of inflation, a telling comparison that though prices were higher than in years past, wages and profits had climbed at a swifter rate. It was his best speech of the day, I thought. Very warm, very much himself, completely in tune with the audience before him. When he finished, we shook hands to the car, and I asked an old lady, picking her as the one that would know, it was much use for this bandstand now. She said, yes, we have a band concert every Saturday night. I am continually surprised these last 6 years at how at home, how in tune I feel with New England. Growing up in Texas, it was a legendary land, the other side of the moon to me. I thought I would feel an utter stranger, but I am charmed with it. We motorcaded to Portland, and there were crowds often along the way on the main turnpike, jammed along the overpasses. Somewhere along the way during the day, Lyndon had stopped, I believe the place was called Topsham, at a Dairy Queen. He's been doing this all his life. There was a sign, Dairy Queen welcomes LBJ, but it was no more eager than his welcome of two heavily piled cones, sweet, late in the day. There had been little eating on this trip, a bite somewhere on the plane, but we were famished as we reached the State Fair at 8 o'clock, an hour and a half past schedule.